Okay, maybe obviously something has gone wrong with the PowerPoint presentation. So that gives me some time to welcome you again. And I'm it was already said, but I'm absolutely overwhelmed by the attendance for this conference. When we started to organize this about more than a year ago, we just couldn't anticipate that this was would happen. So it's really fantastic that so many people came from all over the world. Maybe I can say something to the changes that have you have actually seen in your program already, that we'll have some changes. One reason is that when Kimberly Crenshaw yesterday came to the airport, she found out that her flight was cancelled, so she had to rebook and reschedule her flight, and actually she will be with us hopefully either this afternoon, but she will. We have moved her presentation to be the last presentation tomorrow afternoon, so we have the big bang maybe at the end of the conference, but hopefully what we will be talking about here before is interesting enough for you to stay. Okay. Yes, the title of my talk is Coexisting Inequalities and Other Pitfalls of the Debate on Intersectionality, and I just give you here the overview on how I'm going to do this. Starting with the intro. A year ago, during the US primaries election campaign, Democratic Party voters, feminists among them, were asked to decide between two candidates who could be seen as representatives of historically disadvantaged groups, women and blacks. In the power structure of the United States, as well as in the majority of countries in the industrialized world, both groups are still poorly represented in the upper echelons of the political arena. Both groups have brought forth important social movements and, in the long run, social theory debates on the mechanisms and working power of exclusion and discrimination. If we stick to a classic mono-categorical attribution of identity politics, we can characterize the candidature of these two as a long-term effect of the civil rights movements, Obama, and the second wave of the women's movement, Clinton. Can you see them? Okay. Both candidates were often represented as advocates of one collective, either black or women. However, these collectives are not homogeneous, and therefore, in the course of the primaries, the dispute about the meaning of gender and race divided feminists in the US and elsewhere. While some took the classic feminist position and saying that a vote for Hillary is a vote for ourselves, meaning that women are foremost women, that being female comes before being black, working class, lesbian, or anything else. Others discarded this standpoint of identity politics because it once again forced black women into the position to choose between gender and race, and because it also assumed that in a world of patriarchal power, white women's loyalty, per definition, cannot be with a black man. In her most recent article, in her recent editorial for the European Journal of Women's Studies, Kathy Davis analyzes this debate as one of concern for scholars on both sides of the Atlantic. "We need to use theories of intersectionality," she writes, "to critically analyze and deconstruct the identity politics embedded in political controversies." Davis shows that it is important to investigate in which way various categories of difference have been mobilized to establish or tarnish the respective candidate's credibility. This implies that drawing on one category alone, be it race or gender or class or religion or age and so forth, is not enough to understand the complexity and the ambiguousness of representation of the social in the modern world. Moreover, the fact that Obama, the son of a white American mother and a black African father, is categorized as black, can be regarded as a rather convincing example that these social divisions are not just natural, but rather socially constructed. Nevertheless, they are pervasive and their impact on people's life is immense. In my looking back a bit at the at the debate on this, I first start with the American context. By using this example, I have already arrived at the core of the debate on intersectionality. What is this intersectionality? Is it a theory, a concept, a heuristic device, a method, a methodology, or is it maybe a reading strategy? During the coming 2 days, different answers to this question and various definitions will be given. Kimberly Crenshaw, as the mother of the concept and obviously the one who is important to have here for celebrating this birthday, will come tomorrow, as I already said, or hopefully later this day. A short look into the history of intersectionality shows that it came into being via the so-called race, class, gender debate, which received its main impulse from US black feminism and anti-racist activism in the 1970s. One early documentation of this is the manifest of the Boston-based black lesbian feminist organization, the so-called Combahee River Collective, which in 1977 highlighted the futility of privileging a single dimension of oppression, of oppressive experience. And I quote, "The major source of difficulty in our political work is that we are not just trying to fight oppression on one front or even two, but instead to address a whole range of oppression." End of quote. Their plea for a development of integrated analysis and praxis based upon the fact that the major systems of oppression are interlocking was followed, echoed, and elaborated in black feminist scholars' work, starting with Angela Davis, who actually was a student at this university once, and bell hooks, Valerie Smith, Gloria Hull, Hill Collins, and many, many others over the following years. Through them, it made its way into the American and eventually into the British academic debate. From its conceptualization as so-called triple oppression theory, in which race, class, gender are portrayed as not just adding up together but originating from the same source, but instead focusing on special moments of oppression, race, class, gender was by and by amended with nationality by Floria Anthias and Neera Yuval Davis, sexuality and McClintock, religion, and so forth. We will talk about this in the coming days. Thus, by the early 1990s, the awareness of had evolved that three categories may not be enough to understand societies in the modern world, and that the three categories, race, class, gender, are not distinct and isolated rearms of experience, but on the contrary, they come into existence through contradictory and conflictual relations to each other. In some way, and this I say without any intention to vilify the originator, the coining of intersectionality in the year 1989 was something in the air, the result of a lively debate on both sides of the Atlantic. However, I'm convinced that the fact that the originator, Kimberly Crenshaw, is not a social scientist, but a jurist and a political activist, had a major impact on its rapid dispersion. The debate on human rights and global justice was not only carried out in various committees of the United Nations, but also in many countries around the world. The European Parliament, as one example, was in need of a methodology that could facilitate the implementation and measures for multiple discrimination when it discussed the anti-discrimination legislation, which was eventually adopted and then ratified by the member countries of the European Union. It is obvious that Kimberly Crenshaw's intervention was absorbed quickly into a wide field of disciplines and has inspired transatlantic exchange over the last 20 years. So far, the concept has made its brilliant career first and foremost in women and gender studies. But it is not restricted to this field and has been adopted by migration researchers and by those studying in social inequality. The American sociologist Leslie McCall has made the following statement. One could even say that intersectionality is the most important theoretical contribution that women's studies in conjunction with related fields has made so far. In a review article, McCall evaluates the use of intersectionality and distinguishes between three main approaches. The anti-categorical, the intra-categorical, and the inter-categorical. The anti-categorical approach, heavily influenced by post-structuralism and favored by post-feminists, focuses on the socially constructed nature of gender and other categories. Its aim is the deconstruction of master categories as a way to unpack inequality. Thus, for anti-categorical thinkers, any use of categories is suspect. What does this mean? For a clarification, I use again the Obama example. Barack Obama's self-identification as a post-racial candidate can be seen as a critique of broad and sweeping acts of categorization and as a dismissal of the category in toto. However, many realists disagree with such a standpoint by alluding to racism as an everyday experience of black people, which does not disappear just by a pure act of anti-essentialism thought through the invocation of a new mode of being. I want to make this aspect even more complicated, this question of anti-categorical thinking, by pointing out that in an intersectional twist, one should ask another question, namely, whether it would have been possible for Hillary Clinton, who has often been accused of unfemale, emotionless, manly behavior, to coin herself a post-gender person without being pronounced mad. The answer is rather no, I think. This example shows us that the categories gender and race, as well as class, are not homogeneous. They have completely different origins, in spite of the fact that they are equally pervasive and relevant to everyday practices and ideologies. Coming back to McCall's evaluation scheme, the proponents of the intra-categorical approach do not deny that categories are socially constructed, but they argue for the necessity of keeping them. Their aim is the fine-tuning of the categories, and they identify internal inconsistencies as well as complexity. Finally, the advocates of an intercategorical approach, they look for overlaps and mutual amplifications by reproducing the analysis to one or two intergroup relationships at a time. They do not wish to repudiate or deconstruct the use of categories, but rather focus on what they have in common, without falling back into simplistic deductions of the declaration of the primacy of one category. According to McCall, and she makes also this distinction between the question where it is used methodologically, she said that qualitative researchers seem to be in favor of the first and second approach, and quantitative embrace the intercategorical approach. Whether or not this classification is helpful will be discussed in this conference. I'm coming to the German debate. The German debate on intersectionality, which started relatively late but is in full swing at the moment, is characterized by some peculiarities which I want to talk about briefly. As Mara Max-Ferre will show us in her lecture, German feminists have rather dealt with the relation between gender and race than with the relation between gender and class than with the relation between gender and race. This is important. Race, in fact, is a much rejected and detested category here in Germany, one that seems to have been disposed of. Outside of our constitution, it is hardly used. Though there are indeed many good reasons for getting rid of a category that has proven to be a scientific error, researchers like myself argue that we still need the category as an analytical tool because of its deep embeddedness in German history, including the fascist and the much underestimated colonial part. As early as 1955, Theodor Adorno observed that in post-World War II Germany, the much, how he called it, frowned upon category race had been replaced by the elegant word culture, notwithstanding the fact that despite its conceptual change, its former meaning and assertion was kept. It may therefore not be a surprise, as Axelie Knapp has noticed, that in Germany intersectionality was first picked up by feminist researchers dealing with racism, colonialism, and migration, and was only slowly making its way into the heart of gender studies. However, a widely spread objection here is the fact that taking on board intersectionality will foster the decrease of gender studies. The fear that gender will become a decentralized category and therefore be made superfluous in the academia is often voiced among German scholars. In some universities in Germany, gender studies chairs are indeed being challenged and some have even been abolished, which shows that after many years of fighting for the establishment of academic gender studies, there is no guarantee that this field of expertise will receive credit for its merits and in times of major changes will hold grounds in academia. In my view, though, this has little to do with whether or not intersectionality is integrated into the debate. Another major demur in our debate here is the feeling that intersectionality cannot capture the social developing processes of race, class, gender because of its positioning in this, on the subject level. The social philosopher Cornelia Klinger writes, "It makes no sense to hint at the superimposing and intersecting aspects of class, race, gender in the worlds of the individual experience without being able to specify how and by what means race, class, and gender are constituted as social categories." She questions the suitability of intersectionality outside the analysis of identity formation, thus outside the subject level. While Klinger and Knapp, who are also here and will speak today and tomorrow, adhere to the primacy of no more than three categories, gender, race, and class, others have argued for the amplification of the triad by integrating body. Nina Degler, for instance, and nationality is a lens who was already mentioned. In my own work, together with my colleagues Leibrecht, Wenning, and Krüger-Putratz, I have developed a list of 14 interacting axes of social divisions: gender, sexuality, race, ethnicity, nationality, class, culture, religion, able-bodiedness, age, sedentariness, property ownership, geographical location, north, south, east, west, status in terms of tradition and development, all of which are relevant for the analysis of social inequality depending on the respective context. They can be diversified into three categories: body-oriented, socio-spatial-oriented, and economy-oriented. The openness, as we always said, I mean, this is something that has to be amended. The openness of this list has been problematized as endlessly expandable and therefore not useful for any kind of sound analysis. And we have reacted to that by saying that in the context of studying social inequality, we need theory-oriented concepts, and that they are relevant in the context of the Western world. At the minimum standards, at least three categories are needed for an intersectional analysis. We have also stressed that next to theory, we need empirical research. The latter may require other categories to be added depending on the context and the specifics of the research question. However, we do not wish to say that every difference makes a relevant category, and that, for instance, we would include trivialized divisions like smokers, non-smokers, or spectacle wearers in our model. In their multiple-level analysis model, which seems to be inspired by Floria Anthia's model, Nina Degler and her colleague Winker differentiate between three levels: the structural level, the level of identity construction, and the representational level, and I think that is very helpful. Another proposal in the German debate comes from Katharina Weigenbach, who pleads for redefining gender as an interdependent category that in itself is already interwoven with other categories of social division, and therefore these other categories are to be absorbed by gender as long as one defines it in a multifaceted, ambiguous, and non-essential concept. In my view, one can summarize the German debate among social scientists and educationalists so far, but also jurists so far, by saying that the political impetus, which clearly is represented in the text of Anglo-Saxon scholars, is almost absent in the German debate. Black and migrant organizations have hardly been able to raise their voice in the political arena, let alone in the academy. While in England and the US, many feminist researchers identify themselves as both activists and scholars, this tradition is quite weak in our country. Thus, I could distinguish between four strands of the German debate. The first strand is composed by feminist jurists dealing with anti-discrimination legislation, in which intersectional discrimination is one of the categories applied, they are struggling with the selectivity of this category. The second strand wishes to build a sound and maybe grand theory on the structural level, which not only is able to identify by what and how race, class, and gender as separate categories are constituted as social categories, but also how the big three are positioned to one another in an intercategorical approach. The third strand is outspoken in rejecting this latter objective by saying that it makes no sense to theoretically construct three self-contained categories as mega structures only to identify their interwovenness later. Instead, they rather wish to identify the interwovenness and mutual dependency between the categories from the beginning on all levels. As we will see, this actually is a plea by Diegele, Winker, Weigenbach, and so forth. As we will see this in this conference, their idea comes close to the transversal intersectionality, which is advocated by Neera Yuval Davis. And the fourth strand consists of proponents of the openness and inclusiveness of the categories and pleads for ongoing redefinition and amendment of intersectionality's categories. This group consists of those who are mainly using intersectionality as a heuristic device in the analysis of identity and representation. Here, social actors are no longer assigned to exclusive status groups or collective identity categories, but the question of domination and oppression is the outcome of a complex analysis. For a lack of a better one, I use the quote of the American famous philosopher Nancy Fraser to exemplify this. Rather, individuals are nodes of convergence for multiple cross-cutting axes of subordination, frequently disadvantaged along some axes and simultaneously advantaged along others. They wage struggles for recognition in a modern regime. Taking this approach serious means that intersectionality has come a long way from what Phil Collins told the interlocking system of oppression to one that discerns between strands of discrimination and strands of agency. In my opinion today, one must argue against the classical clear cut in the study of social inequality, where distinction is made between vertical inequality with the primacy of class, sometimes race integrated, or sometimes gender integrated, and non-vertical or horizontal inequalities in which we find all other categories of differentiation. But as axes of difference, they can also compensate for or cushion each other. In this way, in my own work, I feel obliged to empirically investigate gender as a category of discrimination and as a resource for social actors, always in combination with other markers of discrimination and difference. This conference, as it was said, is a birthday celebration for intersectionality. However, when theories and concepts are celebrated, it is never without a critical note. Appreciation as well as criticism and challenge are two necessary components of very serious academic debates. This is why the title of this conference carries a question mark. Within the next 2 days, we will hear scholars from both sides of the Atlantic discuss the question whether or not we, as gender studies scholars, need intersectionality. And it is quite clear that not just one, but many, sometimes contradictory answers to this question will be given. I would like to finish this lecture by confessing that this conference is my dream come true. This is the conference I always wanted to organize, and I'm thankful to the support of many institutions and people who helped me to realize this. First of all, I'm indebted to the Goethe University and the Department of Social Sciences that appointed me to, it was already said, one of Germany's most prestigious gender studies chair, and I'm happy that Ute Gerhard, the first professor, is among us today. Hopefully, I will be able to live up to their high expectations during the coming years. Moreover, I thank the Cornelia Goethe-Zentrum for providing me with an institutional backing and lots of dedication for this project. And together with my colleagues from the Institute for the Analysis of Society and Politics, I hope to collaborate on many innovative studies and events. Without the financial support of the Hessian Ministry of Science and Arts, and here I want to thank in particular Dr. Monika Völker, and the money from sponsors, and they have all been named already, like the Friends and Promoters of the Goethe University, the Consulate General of the Netherlands, the Friends of the Cornelia Goethe Zentrum, the Steering Committee of the University, as well as the Deanery, we would not be here today. I also want to express my deepest gratitude to the wonderful team of organizers, starting with Linda, Lotte, Maria, Teresa, Greta, Nele, Barbara, Stefan, Anke, and Stephanie. Last but not least, I want to thank full-heartedly the speakers who followed my invitation so enthusiastically, and the large audience who came to Frankfurt from all over the world to listen to them and to discuss their thoughts. This conference can also be seen as a follow-up of an earlier event which was organized by the European Journal of Women's Studies some years ago in Amsterdam, and I'm thrilled that the editors and almost the complete board of associate editors is present today. So my humble wish is that the conference will carry us along in a spirit of solidarity and reflexivity. Thank you very much.